Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. Today, I'm going to continue reading the independent member-initiated task force report on Division 35 involvement with PENS and its aftermath. This is part two of the reading. And all of the preliminary material is available on the preceding day's blog, which will be posted on the online. I am starting on page 37, backing up just right before where we left off yesterday. So section begins. Note, 2007, before and after in the news. As a side note, we wish to enter at this point in the report narrative a brief summary of key information that was available before and after 2007. Some of this information indicates what Div 35 members could have known and includes information that reveals that abusive treatment of prisoners had not stopped. In 2003 and 2004, many articles were published regarding allegations of psychological and physical coercion, quote, tantamount to torture, including a November 30th, 2004 article in the New York Times. Hoffman describes this article and others as prompting the PENS Task Force, page 17. In March of 2005, an FBI memo criticizing Gitmo methods was released by the Justice Department, dismissing intelligence obtained by military as, quote, suspect at best, March 22nd, 2005. Jane Mayer's New Yorker article, The Experiment, came out in the July 11th issue of 2005. Mark Benjamin's article on reverse engineering, the CIA's torture teachers, was published in Salon on June 21st, 2007, around the time of the events in this section. There were multiple additional news articles, the Red Cross report in 2007, the Amnesty International reports in 2004 and 2007, and the Senate committee was at this time doing its investigation, resulting in its report on torture in 2008. Many provide confirmation of abusive interrogations that were still occurring after the PENS report was released. Shortly after 2007, there were continued indications that abuse was still taking place. Amnesty International documented that nearly 80% of Gitmo detainees were kept in long-term isolation in cells, often subjected to extreme cold through air conditioning turned on high and lights on 24 hours a day. Amnesty International, 2007. The Department of Justice's DOJ's Office of Professional Regulations report in 2009 indicates that the Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, did not permanently outlaw, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques, EITs, like, quote, dietary manipulation or, quote, isolation up to 30 days. Solds and Reisner's 2016 report, in fact, 1 month before PENS, there was the Bradbury memo, which concluded that the use of the following enhanced interrogation techniques as proposed by the CIA would be lawful. 1. Dietary manipulation. 2. Nudity. 3. Attention grasp. 4. Walling. 5. Facial hold. 6. Facial slap or insult slap. 7. Abdominal slap. 8. Cramped confinement. 9. Wall standing. 10. Stress positions. 11. Water dousing. 12. Sleep deprivation more than 48 hours. And 13. The waterboard. OPR report, 2009, pages 133 to 134. As Solds and Reisner, 2016, write, the April 2006 OLC memo, quote, states that the abusive techniques contained in Appendix M of the 2006 Army Field Manual, FM2-22.3, are legal, end quote, and, quote, potentially provides legal immunity even for the abuses of U.S. citizens overseas, end quote. They write that, quote, various human rights organizations have condemned Appendix M, including Amnesty International, 2009, which described it as likely, quote, sanctioning cruelty. A New York Times article, Alexander 2010, quotes an officer who describes the Army Field Manual as not explicitly prohibiting stress positions, putting detainees into close confinement or environmental manipulation other than hypothermia and, quote, heat injury, opening a window of opportunity for abuse. The Center for Constitutional Rights reported, quote, the conditions in these camps are harshly punitive and violate international and U.S. legal standards for the humane treatment of persons deprived of their liberty, 2009. In 2009 to 2010, reports of abuse in the black jail in Afghanistan came from the BBC, Anderson, 2010A, 2010B, 2010C, The Washington Post, Parlow and Tate, 2009, and The New York Times, Rubin, 2009. There continued to be policies in place via Appendix M of the 2006 Army Field Manual that, quote, ensured that cruelty was sanctioned, in the words of Amnesty International, and that allowed abuses that violate international and U.S. legal standards. Moreover, there were articles available in prominent places with regard to torture and, quote, enhanced interrogations at this crucial year for APA, 2007, as well as after, when the EC-35 was called upon again in 2011 to 2012 to assist the coalition and DSJ. I want to just reiterate any mistakes of pronunciation are my own, and I apologize. I continue. 2007 letters regarding Larry James' participation in enhanced interrogations, quote-unquote enhanced interrogations. In this section, we discuss Larry James' involvement as a preface to discussing Melba Vasquez's letter supporting Larry James. Melba Vasquez, past president of DIV 35, solicited select members of DIV 35, as well as others, to support James, who she believed was being wrongly accused by dissidents. According to Stephen Soltz, one of the dissidents, APA had been asking the coalition to name names or stop throwing around accusations about psychologists participating in torture. Those who had recently formed the coalition wrote an open letter to President Sharon Brem on June 6, 2007. See Appendix G. It is now indisputable that psychologists and this is a quote. It is now indisputable that psychologists and psychology were directly and officially responsible for the development and migration of abusive interrogation techniques, techniques which the International Committee of the Red Cross has labeled, quote, tantamount to torture. Reports of psychologists, along with other health professionals, participation in abusive interrogation surfaced more than 2 years ago, end quote. In this letter, they asked for APA to officially endorse the moratorium resolution noted above and for a neutral third-party investigation of this involvement. Over 40 members signed the letter, including some in DIV 35, Rhoda Unger, Bernice Lott, Linda Wolf, Faye Crosby, and Brinton Likes, Barbara Gutek, Maram Halleck, and possibly others. The contact names on the letter were dissidents Stephen Reisner, Stephen Soltz, and Brad Olson. This letter also pointed to Larry James, as well as other psychologists, Banks, Lefebvre, and Shumate. Banks was one of the military psychologists in charge of the BISCTs, the BSCTs, at the time reported abuses were occurring at Gitmo. See Appendix F for fuller information on Colonel Larry James's knowledge of and actions relative to, quote, enhanced interrogations at both Gitmo and Abu Ghraib. We highlight the section of the letter on James here in this MITF report as background to discussing the strong support for James that came from some members of DIV 35. Quote, Colonel Larry James, a second PENS member, quote, was chief psychologist for the Joint Intelligence Group at Gitmo, Cuba, end quote, PENS Task Force member biographies, starting in 2003. Colonel Larry James has often been cited by Gerald Kucher, Stephen Behnke, and others as the one who, quote, cleaned up Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. The OIG report, however, makes it clear that Guantanamo biscuits play in transforming SEER techniques into standard operating interrogation procedure, that the commander of Guantanamo detainee operations requested official approval for the use of these torture techniques in October 2002, and that permission was granted by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld in December 2002. Additionally, as stated in his Penn's biography in 2003, James, quote, was the chief psychologist for the Joint Intelligence Group at Gitmo, Cuba. In 2004, James was director, Behavioral Science Unit, Joint Interrogation and Debriefing Center at Abu Ghraib. It should be noted that in 2004, according to many sources, General Jeffrey Miller, Guantanamo Commander 2, went from Guantanamo to Iraq and brought the SEER techniques with him. James was the commander of the biscuits at the time. The FBI and other law enforcement agents were reporting that severe abuses were occurring at Guantanamo. The FBI and other criminal investigative task force agents reporting these abuses referred to them as SEER and, quote, SEER, S-E-R-E, and, quote, counter-resistance tactics in documents obtained by the ACLU under the Freedom of Information Act. And see Appendix G for a full letter, end quote. It is important, well, end quote after the Information Act. It is important to note that nothing about Larry James' race was noted in this letter, and several of the individuals we interviewed stated that at this point they didn't know his race. Yet in response to his letter, Melba Vasquez wrote an open letter to Larry James on July 7, 2007, in Appendix H, in defense of James. Quote, we are aware that you are a person of color who has taken a unique leadership role among psychologists in the military. We perceive you to be a hero in your work at Abu Ghraib and develop training and to implement systems to prevent further acts of abuse. We are proud of your application of psychological research, materials, and principles in doing so. End quote. Vasquez also gathered people to support what she saw as a racist attack against James. Personal Communication, Melba Vasquez, January 2016. This letter was originally signed by Div 35 members Laura Brown, Rosie Phillips Bingham, Asuncion Mataria, Austria, Lenore Walker, Martha Banks, Diane S. Salter, Beverly Green, and Sandra Shulman. After the open letter was sent, Vasquez gathered additional signatures, including the names of persons recognized as Div 35 leaders: Jean Lau Chin, Catherine Nordle, Nadine Caslow, Natalie Porter, and Susan McDaniel. See email in Appendix H. Joan Chrysler discussed the Vasquez letter and stated that the DSJ members and APA called it the, quote, Division 35 letter. She stated she resented this because she was Div 35 president at the time and wasn't asked about it, and the letter didn't come out of EC 35. Quote, that letter did a lot of damage to us, end quote. When interviewed, Maureen McHugh, also a past president of Div 35, recalled that Vasquez did not circulate the letter broadly. McHugh was not approached to sign, but she believed that this was because the signatures were from, quote, pretty high-level people, end quote. Later, McHugh was, quote, horrified when people referred to the letter as the, quote, Division 35 letter. McHugh clarified that she was most horrified that Vasquez had asked most, if not all, of the senior people in Div 35 to sign it without bringing it out into the open for all Div 35 members to consider. We also spoke to some of the Div 35 members who signed the letter. Rosie Bingham, who was on the retreat planning committee for the midwinter 2016 executive committee meeting, when asked about the letter, stated she didn't remember signing it. When interviewed, Laura Brown said she was aware of the letter but not particularly interested in it at the time. She added, quote, if Melba asks me to sign something, I usually do, end quote. Natalie Porter initially said in an email on January 12, 2016, that she believed she signed it because she trusted Melba. Later, she clarified and said that she didn't want to, quote, dump it all on Melba, and recalled that there were documents that accompanied the letter that indicated James hadn't been at Gitmo when the alleged torture was occurring. Porter told us that James himself had said something very compelling that she couldn't remember. Porter also stated that people whom she trusted, quote, did their homework. Although she had read the letter by Olson, Reisner, and Saltz, she determined there was, quote, overreach on their part in them naming of James as if he was, quote, responsible for everything. It may be important to note here that the letter to Brehm by Olson, Reisner, and Saltz discussed three individuals in depth and not only Larry James. Members of the MITF do not have access to accompanying documents to which Porter referred. According to available documents to the MITF, James asserted he wasn't even at Gitmo or Abu Ghraib during the time when the abuses was supposed to have occurred. Other documentation strongly suggests otherwise. See Appendix F for a timeline of James's involvement. Even today, Morgan Banks is still insistent that the DOD's policies did not authorize abuse or torture by the time of the Penn's task force. However, see Saltz and Reisner 2016 for documentation of all the abuses that occurred, that continue to occur during and after the Penn's task force. The Appendix M of the Army Field Manual was still in effect during and after the Penn's task force and was condemned by human rights groups. Although the coalition did not state that James was directly involved with abusive interrogations at Gitmo while there between 2003 and 2004, they did state in their letter to Brehm that James left Gitmo claiming to have, quote, fixed all such abuses, which, when clearly, he had not. Moreover, the biscuit he had been in charge of when there continued with abusive interrogations. See the previous section above for news confirmation of this. The biscuits were accused of abuses of a couple of months after James left Gitmo. And in 2004, there were Red Cross reports of the, quote, frequent flyer program where one inmate was made to switch cells 128 times in 14 days, thus making this tantamount to sleep deprivation. Lewis, 2004. The torture of one inmate, Slahey, was so disturbing that Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch resigned his position as prosecutor at Gitmo because of that. The torture of Slahey began only weeks after James left. Slahey writes, By January 2003, military interrogators were agitating to make Slahey their second, quote, special project, drawing up an interrogation plan that mirrored Qahtani's declassification documents show that Slahey's special interrogation began when he was transferred to an isolation cell near the end of May, Slahey 2013. The Center for Torture Accountability, no date, stated that Colonel Larry James was brought in from Washington to head up psychology operations for detainees at Gitmo in 2003, at the same time when people in charge of running these prisons were incorporating, quote, enhanced interrogation techniques into previously standard and non-abusive interrogation procedures. Again, see Appendix F for a timeline of James's involvement taken from multiple sources, as well as from James' own 2008 book, Fixing Hell. After the June coalition letter to Brehm, but before the response from Vasquez in support of James, Behnke arranged for James to speak at the 2007 COR meeting, and according to Hoffman, drafted a speech for him. Hoffman states the presentation by James was, quote, notable by many interviewed, and in the speech, people remembered he said, quote, people will die if psychologists were not permitted to work in such detention settings. Hoffman, page 425, and Democracy Now, 2010. Hoffman noted that those interviewed thought that the asking of man to step down was not normal, but no one he interviewed confirmed that as Div 19 Council representative, she was asked to step down. Specifically, in order to enable James to speak at the meeting. Hoffman agreed, however, with the interpretation of those interviewed who believed this was the reason Manny was asked to step down. Thus, Vasquez's letter was part of an overarching effort to support James the summer of 2007. When asked if the Vasquez letter played a part in supporting Pence and obstructing the dissidents, Soltz said, quote, tremendously, and quote, they were able to use this to influence people on council that we were bullies. James, end quote. James was saying at the time that the Red Cross were America-hating hippies and lied in their report. With Vasquez's support, people believed James when he claimed to, quote, fix hell. According to Hoffman, in 2007, Behnke was working behind the scenes to get the moratorium resolution out of play and did so by bringing in a number of groups to create a substitute resolution. Also, at every step along the way, he was consulting with Morgan Banks of the DOD for approval. At the August 2007 COR meeting, when the moratorium resolution was defeated, Behnke arranged for James to give a speech. Behnke and Brehm agreed James was well-respected at COR. According to Soltz, part of his respect among council members came from the support he had from prominent Div 35 members and people of color who appeared convinced that the attack on him had racist overtones. Thus, the Vasquez letter and some Div 35 leaders' support of it may have played a part in James' arguments against the moratorium resolution. Why were members of Div 35 not concerned with James' potential support of torture or, quote, enhanced interrogations? Why were they more likely to take the word of a colleague who said he was, quote, helping or that he was, quote, fixing hell, rather than the multiple reports that were arising in the news? At the very least, the Amnesty International report was out before the exchange of letters in June 2007. See Timeline of News in Appendices A and C for others. Next section. 2007 San Francisco APA Convention Division 35 EC 35 meeting. This section marks the beginning of Div 35's executive committee's involvement in the controversies over PENS. Below, we look at 2007, 2011-12, and 2015-16 as important moments in which the division could have joined the protesters' efforts, but failed to do so for a variety of reasons. Joan Chrysler was president of Div 35 at the August 2007 EC 35 meeting in San Francisco. At the time, she did not know much about the PENS task force, but remembers that Rhoda Unger and perhaps Bernice Lott, acting as representatives of SPSSI, while also longstanding Div 35 members, asked that Div 35 take a stand against the PENS report, saying that the PENS task force process was inappropriate and its conclusions were incorrect. Chrysler recalls that Laura Brown was a Div 35 council representative at the time and took a strong stand on the other side. Brown's position, as Chrysler recalls it, was that if you took a strong stand, you were going against military psychologists and that it wasn't fair to turn against our colleagues, that our colleagues have to make a living, and that psychologists in those military situations could do a lot of good. Brown, looking back at this time, describes her position as wanting psychologists to be on site at Gitmo, quote, so we can blow whistles and prevent things. As she recalled at the time, she was not concerned with Mitchell and Jetson and not concerned when Mitchell and Jessen were named because she knew they weren't APA members, which meant there was nothing APA could do about it. Mitchell resigned from APA in 2006, Hoffman, page 504. Brown did not, and still does not, agree with a, quote, moratorium. She reported to us because she thinks that, quote, educating interrogators using, quote, psychological science is the best course of action at Gitmo, but not the black sites. She related that her stance was that we as psychologists had research that could put psychologists in an educative role. According to several people interviewed, Brown was very persuasive at the meeting. Chrysler believed that Brown was such a strong voice and so very well respected that EC35 members were swayed by what she said. This resulted in many being unwilling to take a stand at all. McHugh also recalled this meeting and stated that she was, quote, confused because she respected Brown so much, but their views differed. As McHugh recalled, there was no vote by EC35. They just did not offer support for the moratorium resolution as a division. In support of this, Chrysler stated that, quote, most of the EC was blindsided and confused, so were unable to take a stand. Chrysler also recalls that Unger told her that there was a whisper campaign against her, calling her a racist, after which she felt marginalized by Div 35. It was a few days after that EC 35 meeting that the APA mini convention on ethics and interrogation took place, August 19, 2007. This was the mini convention in which Jean Maria Arrigo gave her talk that exposed the conflicts of interest in the Penn's task force and other information about abusive interrogations was shared. Chrysler stated she was horrified by what she heard there and embarrassed that Div 35 wasn't on the right side of the issue by failing to take a stand. Bullying by dissidents. Brown also explained that hers and others' resistance to the dissidents was in part a result of the dissidents' behavior, tone, race, and gender. She described the dissidents as white men who exhibited, quote, extreme bullying behavior by anyone who disagreed with them. Brown named Olson, Idelson, Reisner, and Tajirian specifically and said that, quote, if you didn't agree with what they said, they viciously personally attacked you. When asked how, she stated that one time on the DSJ listserv, Olson accused her of not believing in social justice. She also didn't agree with the strategy of the protesters and didn't find them, quote, credible, given their bullying style. When interviewed, Brad Olson disagreed that there was bullying or vicious personal attacks on the listserv or at face-to-face meetings of the DSJ, but also stated he could understand how others might perceive what occurred as bullying. Stoltz said there may have been examples of strong language, but that those on the other side of the arguments were quick to call strong language, quote, bullying, and describe themselves as victims. One example Olson gave when someone whom he called a, quote, troll, a person on a listserv that sows discord and not one of the primary dissidents, used the phrase, quote, like putting lipstick on pigs. This was interpreted as calling the women in opposition to the dissidents, quote, pigs. Another example Olson gave was Brown's citing of, quote, slander as similar to murder, according to Judaism. Solds reported he perceived this as comparing the dissidents to murderers. As Brown wrote, quote, since various folks on this listserv have been instrumental in sending the open letter to Sharon Brem, I believe it's worthwhile to read what Larry James, a colleague accused of misconduct in that letter, has to say for himself. I'm passing this along. It came to me via Melba Vasquez, a member of the APA BOD, as well as of the executive committees of two divisions, 35 and 56, that are members of DSJ. I want to note that making accusations about someone by name may itself raise questions of ethics. While some here may scoff at comparing participation, knowing or otherwise, in interrogations with slander, each in their own way violates our values. Jewish ethics, which inform my thinking, say that slander is the equivalent of murder. Thus, in Jewish communities, we work against lashon hara, literally evil tongue, but usually translated as gossip because of its potential for damage. I believe that no strategy which creates human collateral damage is one which ultimately supports social justice. June 20th, 2007, post by Laura Brown to DSJ Social Justice Discussion Forum, APA listserv. Another example of something that Brown perceived got her, quote, trashed on the listserv was when she was, quote, echoing Jessica Henderson Daniel, whose dad was in the Air Force, end quote, and that, quote, what we were doing would penalize men in the Air Force and their family members as well. Brown saw herself and others as standing up for military personnel and their families. While Brown did not mention Martha Banks, Benke saw Martha Banks, a long-standing Div 35 member, also as someone who would support the military because of, quote, military connections. See Hoffman Report, Binder 2, email from Benke to Morgan Sammons, Friday, August 3rd, 2007. Martha Banks later became president of Div 35. Lori Brown also noted that at the time, she felt that the dissidents were hypocritical, quote, ignoring the fate of the men of color in the U.S. prison system who were subjected to similar things they were protesting. Brown also said that she felt the dissidents' stance toward military psychologists and their families was characterized by, quote, we don't care about their families, we don't care about them, we don't care what happens to them, end quote. We could not find this kind of statement when searching the DSJ discussion listserv archives, and when asked about it, Brad Olson said that Tajarian had been accused of saying that, but that Tajarian never made such a statement. Lori Brown's concerns regarding the moratorium resolution. Lori Brown's concerns regarding the moratorium resolution and the response to the Penn's task force report were addressed in our interview with Jean Maria Arrigo. With regard to Mitchell and Jessen not being APA members, Dr. Brown may not have known the whole story. During 2003, when there were some of the, quote, enhanced interrogations that included waterboarding, Mitchell was an APA member. He resigned in 2006. She may also not have known that they both continued to be associated with APA. They gave APA continuing education courses, according to Arrigo, up until 2006. Further, as the emails presented in, quote, all the president's psychologists demonstrate, Solds, Raymond, and Reisner, 2015, several APA staff were on a first-name basis with Mitchell and Jessen, and the 2005 article by Jane Mayer, titled The Experiment, read by several APA staff, had Mitchell recommending that detainees be treated like dogs, a reference to Seligman's Learned Helplessness experiments, Mayer, 2005. Arrigo addressed the claim that it was a good thing to have psychologists present at interrogations, that it contributed to the prevention of torture. She had archived an interview with an Army commander of an interrogation unit in the First Gulf War, Intelligence Ethics Collection, Hoover Institution Archives, who stated that having psychologists there for SEER training actually enabled interrogators to go further than they would have. Anonymous et al., 2008, June 29. This same view was also articulated by experts in the award-winning documentary film Doctors of the Dark Side, Kerman and Davis, 2011. Dr. Brown would not have likely had that specific information at that time, and so was probably repeating APA's and James's rationales. When asked about whether military families would be hurt if psychologist participation in interrogations was to be stopped, Arrigo argued that the military constantly reassigns people and those in the military would not lose their jobs, although perhaps career opportunities for independent contractors would be much more vulnerable. In addition, there were only a small number of biscuits, probably less than 20 at any one time. With regard to the accusation that Div 35 was not concerned with the prison system, Arrigo argued that the Penn's task force was called on to set policy for military psychologists in national security detention settings, not domestic prison settings. The institutions are completely different in that if you are a moral dissident in the military, you can be court-martialed and sent to prison. It's very rare that a prison psychologist would also be credentialed as a prison guard or warden. Prison psychologists can leave at any time and can't be put in prison for stating moral objections. Arrigo added that we have also never heard the commander-in-chief say people in prison should be tortured. Finally, she noted that whether or not Div 35 should take on social justice activism regarding prisoners' treatment is a matter that could be taken up by Div 35, that work on one social justice issue does not preclude work on another. New attention to an issue does not necessarily represent hypocrisy, but an entry into the specifics of a new institutional and cultural domain. When the issues of dissidents' alleged ignoring of abuses in prison was raised with Soltz, he commented that this was at best only partially true. Many dissidents were actually aware of the horrific prison abuse. However, national security torture was terrifying because it was the first time the government explicitly authorized and claimed legal sanction for torture. Thus, were national security abuses to go unchallenged, it would legitimate other forms of torture of abuse in other settings. Further, dissidents had extended discussions about their primary focus on national security torture. They were aware that their opponents were trying to rally forensic and prison psychologists against the dissidents by suggesting that the dissidents would come after them next. Reluctantly, the dissidents decided that to speak out too strongly about domestic prison abuses at that point would give ammunition to these opponents. In recent years, several dissidents have been active in efforts to reform domestic prisons and criminal justice settings. For example, they have spoken out forcefully against solitary confinement and police violence. Soltz told us that if others among the critics had forcefully taken up domestic prison abuses, the dissidents would have loudly applauded and joined the efforts. In summary, we have attempted to represent the EC35 meeting at which the moratorium resolution was discussed, which was held after the strong support of Div 35 leaders for Larry James in June and July of 2007 via Vasquez's letter, but before the mini-convention. It appears that Laura Brown and Jessica Henderson Daniel were persuasive voices at this EC35 meeting. The issue of whether or not to support the moratorium resolution did not come to a vote. Instead, the issue seemed to have been dropped. The issue raised by Vasquez, Brown, and Henderson Daniel about military families and the abuses in the prison system appear to be arguments that likely persuaded the EC35 members not to support the resolution. Next section. 2007 Mini-Convention on Ethics and Interrogation at APA Convention, San Francisco, August. We include this description of the 2007 Mini-Convention to document what information was available to all in Div 35 via Arrigo's speech and how Moorhead Slaughter responded to the information Arrigo provided. APA BOD funded a mini convention on ethics and interrogations in response to the request from the DSJ. Benke's wish to give the Penn's report a venue for both sides of the issue to be aired, and according to Arrigo, APA's concern for, quote, damage control. There was a total of 9 2-hour sessions at this mini convention, and the majority of people on the program were affiliated with the DSJ. Democracy Now! Filmed several sessions, including a town hall meeting. It should be noted that the mini-convention took place before the final day of the COR meeting when the 2007 moratorium resolution was to be voted on. Arrigo states that Brad Olson had to work very hard to get her on the mini-convention program, and APA scheduled her in a session that largely overlapped another session in which she presented. Arrigo's 11-minute presentation concluded with a 2-minute recorded statement from David DeBato, an Iraq War veteran and retired U.S. Army counterintelligence special agent, Democracy Now! 2007. According to Arrigo, DeBato had been a counterintelligence operative, someone who had been, quote, chasing down terrorists for the government. Before speaking with DeBato, Arrigo stated that she had consulted moral philosopher Charles Jung with regard to the confidentiality agreement at the Penn's task force meeting. Arrigo told us that Jung explained to her that a promise is not binding when the promiser has been deceived into making the promise. That is, the lack of disclosure of the Newman-Dunovan conflict of interest was the kind of deception that invalidated the promise of confidentiality. Arrigo then asked DeBato to help her make sense of the Penn's task force meeting. From the bios of the official list of Penn's task force participants, Arrigo's list of unofficial Penn's task force participants, so-called observers, and APA science policy news information about participants, DeBato inferred that the Penn's task force was a typical counterintelligence, quote, social legitimization process for a decision made at a higher level. Stunned by this interpretation, Arrigo consulted with a former counterintelligence officer and whistleblower she had known for years, military historian Lawrence Rockwood. He gave the same interpretation as DiBatto, emphasizing that everyone invited to the meeting would have undergone a thorough background check. At the mini-convention, Arrigo discussed the conflicts of interest within the Penn's task force process and the observers in the room who reported to other government agencies, according to DiBatto and Rockwood. Except for a few introductory sentences, most of Arrigo's presentations there was broadcast on Democracy Now! 2007. During the mini-convention panel that Moorhead Slaughter chaired, Arrigo remembers Moorhead Slaughter, quote, looking daggers at her. After Democracy Now! Reported on Arrigo's presentation, Gerald Kucher posted a blog entry stating that Arrigo's father's suicide and, quote, troubled upbringing accounted for her views. However, Arrigo's father was alive at the time of the blog entry. Olivia Moorhead Slaughter's letter in response to many convention accusations. On September 5, 2007, Moorhead Slaughter wrote a letter to APA President Sharon Brem that objected to what was said and or implied by Arrigo at the mini-convention and reported on Democracy Now! Moorhead Slaughter stated in this letter, Appendix I, that Arrigo's presentation was a gross distortion of what had happened in the Penn's task force process. In describing her participation in various APA committees, Moorhead Slaughter said that she had served with no compensation, adding that, quote, APA activities have never been counted toward my professional development, end quote, and that any implication that she was rewarded for her positions or service was a, quote, insult to her, quote, integrity. According to a response to her letter by the coalition, this statement wrongly insinuated that Arrigo made this accusation of Moorhead Slaughter. Moorhead Slaughter's letter went on to argue against Arrigo's statement, as the Hoffman Report later confirmed that members of the Penn's task force and other people in the room during the Penn's task force meetings were, quote, covertly providing information to the military or had significant conflicts of interest that would predetermine a position, end quote. Moorhead Slaughter also argued that the biographies of all members were made open to the public, so there was no hidden conflict of interest. This is not completely accurate. Although Division 48 had posted the biographies of the Penn's task force members on their website in May 2005 before the task force met, after the task force produced its report and after the APA board released the Penn's report, they did not list the members of the Penn's task force on the report or elsewhere, quote, due to sensitivities of some members, Hoffman, page 245. It may be that APA didn't realize that someone in Div 48 had already posted the names. And according to the coalition, who were members of Div 48, they also did not know the names had been posted there. According to Arrigo, APA had still not publicly named members of the Penn's task force, observers present in the Penn's task force meetings, or their military connections until the Hoffman Report came out. To support the accusation that APA did not make the names public as Moorhead Slaughter insisted they did, see the September 19, 2007 letter by the coalition that describes their attempts to obtain those names, Appendix I. In this same letter to APA President Sharon Brem, Moorhead Slaughter countered Arrigo's assertions that, quote, no task force member was permitted to speak about the Penn's report by suggesting this assertion could not be true, as evidenced by the fact that Arrigo had spoken quite a bit about the Penn's task force since the time of the Penn's task force meetings. However, Arrigo did not speak until a year later, after she sought out ethical advice about the confidentiality agreement that had been created around Penn's. In the letter, Moorhead Slaughter then complimented other committee members, including Gels and James, about whom she writes, quote, the work of Dr. Larry James in implementing procedures to prevent further abuses at Abu Ghraib has been described in a recent book by a former APA president, end quote. She also disagreed that there were, quote, significant conflicts of interest, and she argued that many of the members of the Penn's task force have taken actions to fight against detainee abuse. She then quoted Arrigo's comments to her after the Pens task force meeting and indicated that Arrigo's comments showed that she actually had supported the process. These are the comments that Hoffman described as a, quote, unfair representation of Arrigo's point of view, Hoffman, page 26, and that are also addressed in the coalition letter of September 19, 2007. The Hoffman report reveals that neither at the time of the Pens task force nor later when interviewed by Hoffman did Dr. Arrigo understand the extent of the collusion by Morgan Banks, the DOD officer in close contact with Banky throughout the process. The Moorhead Slaughter letter of September 5, 2007 clearly shows that she was aware of the conflicts of interest that Arrigo named and that she was made aware in 2007, if not earlier, that, quote, abuses were observed during the time when at least three Penn's task force members were a part of the implicated chains of command, end quote. See coalition letter in September 17, 2007. Her statement in her September 5th letter that there had been no abuses since 2003 was flatly contradicted by several news reports and evidence given to her in the September 17th, 2007 coalition letter. She herself knew of the Independent Red Cross report of 2004. Hoffman states that the vast majority of Moorhead Slaughter's personal letters and emails to the Penn's task force members were written by Banky and passed along to others as her own. The September 19th letter may have also been written by Banky. In summary, Olivia Moorhead Slaughter seemed to disregard dissent or actively contradict the statements made by Arrigo at the 2007 convention. Arrigo believes that Moorhead Slaughter was speaking for Banky. Her staunch defense of the process, her minimizing the severe conflicts of interest of the task force members as, quote, not significant, even though at least three were in the chain of command at Gitmo, and her dismissal of reports by the New York Times, the Red Cross, and the Coalition contradict an excuse of not knowing, which is her current stance. Next section, 2008 referendum. We include this section on the 2008 referendum in order to document the process toward the Penn's annulment that over time Div 35 either ignored or obstructed. Dan Albers was the driving force initiator behind a 2008 APA member-passed referendum affirming as APA policy that psychologists may not work in sites operating outside of or in violation of international law or the Constitution, such as Gitmo, Bagram, or the CIA black site prisons, unless they work directly for the detainees or are treating U.S. service members. We include this here as part of the overall narrative, even though Div 35 did not have an active role in this. It is interesting to note that at the time, those behind the resolution, according to Arrigo, didn't know that passing the resolution wasn't enough. The resolution had to be accepted by the Ethics Committee and entered into the Ethics Code. The 23B motion that was passed in 2015 was the continuation that made it enforceable. Hoffman 2015 notes, however, that James saw the wording of this referendum as part of a coup. James wrote to a group of military psychologists, quote, the real victory is that no part of the recommendations will be a part of council's SIC report or APA policy. It will only say that psychologists can't work in unlawful SIC detention facilities. Page 448. Next section, summer 2009. This section is included as a way of tracking what was going on in the division around the times at which COR was considering various resolutions. The newsletter, The Feminist Psychologist, summarizes a report by Div 35 Council Representatives Laura Brown and Sunian Materia, Sioni, Austria, sorry. They informed the EC35 that APA-COR accepted a report by a group implementing the petition resolution that was passed in 2008. The reported they reported to DIB 35 that COR accepted several other documents germane to the concerns of the Society for Psychology of Women, SPW, including the final report of Joint Division 19 Military and Division 44 LGBT Task Force on Sexual Orientation and Military Service. SPW is the name of the society that is DIV 35. They also wrote and that they represented DIV 35 by supporting Mel Velasquez's APA presidential campaign. They wrote, quote, "Your SPW reps serve in the leadership of the Women's Caucus, WC, at Council, Laura Brown serving as chair, Sione Austria serving as member at large. The WC has two charges, promoting women in governance and promoting women's issues on the council agenda. The focus that year they informed the EC and DIV 35 members through the newsletters had been on governance and the pipeline of women into the highest levels of APA leadership. As such, WC had been promoting the APA presidential campaign of SPW past President Melba Vasquez and donated $1,000 to her campaign," end quote. The winter 2010 newsletter reported the minutes from the above meeting stating Vasquez, quote, "shared ways she intends to integrate women's issues and concerns into her presidency. She also discussed the need to use our social psychological research to examine, prevent, and educate people about the current backlash against ethnic minorities. She is also interested in finding ways to share the psychological literature with community and brand APA in a positive way," end quote. The minutes state, quote, "Melba thanked SPW for our endorsement and asked us to encourage fellow APA members to vote in the election. Laura Brown requested that EC 35 members contribute funds to support Melba's candidacy," end quote. In this newsletter, we see the word, quote, "pipeline" used, a word that we pick up on in our own analysis later. We're aware that DIV 35 sees as a that DIV 35 sees as part of its mission, placing women in the leadership pipeline. This mission is also something we address in our analysis and recommendations. Next section, 2011 Executive Committee Meeting through 2012 Midwinter Meeting in San Antonio. This section marks an important moment for potential change in the division, a lost opportunity. The coalition initiated the PENS annulment petition and attempted to get all APA divisions to sign it. The letter from Roy Edelson to DIV 35, along with the petition, is found in Appendix J. Some divisions signed on to the petition and some did not. There were heated debates in DIV 35 at the 2011 August division meeting regarding the wording in the petition. Although many members agreed with the petition in general, there were some who argued about the wording and whether or not members had enough information to know whether the information connected to the petition was true. Those we interviewed seemed to agree that there was considerable tension at both meetings. Interviewees often did not differentiate between the 2011 August EC 35 meeting and the 2012 midwinter EC 35 meeting in their memories. Thus, in interviewees' quotes shown below, it may be unclear which of the two meetings each interviewee is referring to. However, based on emails sent to us by Stephanie Shields and Roy Edelson, most of the discussion regarding the decision not to support the petition seems to have taken place at the 2012 midwinter meeting. Several individuals interviewed recall that Joan Chrysler, a past president of the DSJ and DIV 35, as well as a council representative at the time, stated that failing to sign on to the petition would be viewed as a sign of lack of support for the DSJ. Chrysler confirmed this in her interview. On the other side of the issue, Jean Lau Chin, also a council representative at the time, made arguments against the specific wording of the petition. While Chin did not respond to the MITF's invitation for an interview, Chrysler's description of events is consistent with many other interviewees on both sides of the issues and consistent with Shields' description of the meeting that appeared in an email she sent to the extended EC, which she provided to the MITF. Chrysler stated that one of her concerns was that DIV 35 did not take, quote, an appropriate stand in 2007, and she wanted DIV 35 to make up for that error in 2011. She recalled, however, that many who objected to the petition thought the petition's wording was too, quote, strident and, quote, strong. Her interpretation of Chin's perspective was that Chin wanted to protect APA, and at the time, APA was stating that the Red Cross report was false. Note, there were two Red Cross reports, one from 2004 on Gitmo that had been discussed in the news, and another, more secret, 2007 report on CIA torture that was not leaked to the public until 2009. As Chrysler recalled, she noted that Rakshanda Saleem, who was new to DIV 35, was on her, quote, side of the argument, and that Maureen McHugh also supported signing the petition. McHugh recalls Laura Brown standing up and saying, quote, we need to support our psychologists in the military, and many people made their living that way, and that many of them were people of color, end quote. McHugh said in her interview that the implication was that if you didn't support the military, you were racist. She stated, quote, I remember being surprised about that. I didn't think this was an issue of race. Chrysler stated during her interview that no one supported torture per se, that many had read the New York Times reports about torture, and yet many remained focused on the, quote, tone of the petition, in her opinion. There was something about the tone that some felt was, quote, unladylike. She also recalled that Natalie Porter tried to be a, quote, peacemaker. Consensus was not reached at this DIV 35 meeting, and the discussion was moved to the APA community's website. Chrysler recalled that then-President Stephanie Shields was trying to be a neutral chair and come up with a standard feminist process for DIV 35 to respond to requests from outside organizations. Natalie Porter's memories of the meeting match Chrysler's to the extent that Porter recalled the general feeling in the EC meeting, where people appeared to agree with the petition but were unsure about the wording. Porter stated that members, quote, wanted to support the strength of the message without wading into waters of what was accurate or not. But there was still moral outrage about the torture. Porter recalled that when the decision was made to write a separate document, those advocating this course of action didn't think it would weaken the petition and thought it would support the outcome they wanted. Chrysler stated that there were several concerns voiced. She had the impression that EC35 didn't want to be associated with PSYSR, quote, those people, because they were too radical, too critical of APA, and not, quote, nice. She recalled that some people didn't like the petition language, calling it, quote, too strong, and making assertions that they couldn't, quote, verify what was in it. According to Chrysler, there was also a desire to support the petition, stopping torture, without supporting what the dissidents at the time were implying about certain individuals at the time. Susan Basso wrote in an email to the MITF that at the 2011 meeting, she was, quote, surprised at the diversity of viewpoints by people whose views, added, she respected. She recalls in particular Joan Chrysler's argument to support the statement and Laura Brown's arguments about problematic wording. She recalled that everyone was against supporting torture in any form, but the debate was over how best to communicate that. Basso said that creating a separate statement seemed like a compromise, even though Chrysler pointed out to the group that a separate statement would be viewed as non-supportive. Basso also stated that Chrysler, quote, was proven right, while Basso praised Stephanie Shields for her attempts to make sure people's voices were heard, arguments were presented, and procedures were followed. Basso believed that DIV 35, quote, got caught up in being civil and moderate and in its own uniqueness. Minutes from the DIV 35 midwinter meeting in January 2012 also support information obtained from general interviews where they indicate that Chrysler discussed, quote, issues that have, quote, been circulating on listservs, and that it was clarified at the meeting that council representatives vote with both their conscience in COR meetings and in ways that are consistent with the goals and missions of DIV 35. The minutes state, quote, DIV 35 has been asked to join with these divisions and sign this petition for annulment of the PENS report. Inaction makes an implicit statement that does not reflect our solidarity with social justice divisions. Council Representative Jean Lau Chin summarized the contrasting view that in order for military psychologists to remain employed by the government, they must follow military and legal mandates. She added that COR actions taken since the PENS report demonstrate that APA, in fact, does not condone torture. When the extended EC discussed the PENS report in 2005, a majority of extended EC members present voted to recommend that the report be accepted by the Board of APA. Some felt that the process used at the time on the volatile and divisive issues had not sufficiently allowed for a wide and open discussion and feminist process. The minutes reflect that some members, quote, did not feel they had enough information to be able to decide on whether or not to endorse the petition, end quote. Note that this statement calls for a, quote, recall rather than an annulment, which Roy Edelson explained would mean that PENS was never valid. The minutes also state that EC 35 decided to develop its own statement, and past presidents Thelma Byron Davis and Natalie Porter agreed to develop the statement. The minutes further show that Chrysler suggested that the separate statement at least include, quote, we stand with the Psychologists for Social Responsibility, PSYSR, and Divisions of Social Justice in supporting the reconsideration and recall of the PENS Task Force report. These minutes also reflect that Shields noted that DIV 35 doesn't have an established process in terms of how they take a position when requested to do so by a member or outside group, but that the process by which they would seek feedback from members had to be quick because COR was meeting 2 weeks after the 2012 midwinter meeting. An email from Stephanie Shields to the extended EC members dated January 22, 2012, asked members to review the petition documents and post comments by February 15, 2012. In a later email on February 10th, Shields informed members about the process that EC 35 had used at the midwinter meeting to develop DIV 35's own statement, and that doing so was unanimously approved by EC 35, and once again asked extended EC members to log into the APA community's website to post comments on by February 15th, 2012. In the February 10th email, Shields reported to the extended EC at the executive committee meeting, we had a lengthy and detailed discussion, which ultimately led to a strong majority opinion that SPW's commitment to social justice compels us to speak to the issue and that the PSYSR's statement was not a vehicle for us to use. To make a long story short, those voting private ballot unanimously agreed with past President Thelma Bryant Davis and Appointment Committee Chair and SPW past President Natalie Porter should draft a brief position statement that would then be put to a poll by the extended executive committee. Shields also noted in her call for a vote that those who came to this decision were guided by a desire to honor feminist process and follow the SPW bylaws. The DIV 35 statement that Thelma Bryant Davis and Natalie Porter drafted is as follows, but does not overtly address psychologists' involvement in abusive interrogations. Quote, in light of discussions regarding APA's position on psychologists' involvement in situations with potential for human rights violation, the Society for the Psychology of Women, DIV 35, affirms our position on human rights, which prioritizes the safety, justice, and well-being of all people. The Society for the Psychology of Women condemns the use of torture under all circumstances, recognizing torture as violation of both human rights and professional ethics. Given that the PENS report does not provide a clear statement against the use of torture as a human rights violation, SPW stands with other APA divisions on social justice in requesting its recall and reconsideration. We call for APA to state unequivocally that torture is a violation of both human rights and psychologists' professional ethics, end quote. While discussing this meeting, one interviewee who wishes to remain anonymous recalled that EC35 meetings were, quote, humongous and intimidating, and that the words, quote, feminist process was evoked unpredictably. We will return to this observation in the analysis and recommendations section. The statement was sent to APA when completed, including then APA President Melba Vasquez. Shields did not send the statement to the coalition. Edelson, who had last written to Shields before the midwinter meeting, wrote to Shields on April 18th. He asked about supporting the petition one more time and asked to see the statement he had heard about. It was at this time that Shields finally let him know that Div 35 was not signing the petition. When asked why not, she wrote, "We have a large and diverse membership with a range of opinions on the issue. Our statement is one that we and SPW have endorsed collectively." It must also be noted that during this 2011-2012 period, Vasquez gave a 2011 statement in an open letter as then APA president to the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology stating that, quote, "It has been falsely asserted that the American Psychological Association colluded with the Bush administration in the harmful detention and interrogation practices of the, quote, war on terror. She has yet to publicly refute this statement." In summary, this was clearly a difficult time for Div 35, but themes emerged that are echoed in earlier and later meetings. While no one could specifically point to the wording of the petition that was problematic or couldn't be verified, some had impressions of why the wording was problematic and why Div 35 did not want to support the annulment petition. Similar to what happened in 2007, the same arguments were made that military personnel would lose jobs and that there was an implication that to not support the military was racist. There was also some objection to petition language that one interviewee believed had to do with the wording being, quote, unladylike or strident. Another person thought that what was problematic about the petition was that it blamed APA. Given that Div 35's final statement actually said that Div 35 supported a, quote, recall of the Pens report, it seems unlikely that the problematic points in the petition and facts that couldn't be verified had to do with the criticism of Pens process by extension, APA. Next section. 2012 to 2013. Member-initiated task force associated with Division 48, Wolf 2012, MITF. This section is included because it was experienced by the coalition as a serious undermining of their efforts and was organized by a current Div 35 member, Linda Wolf. We also include this description of the first MITF because this set precedent for member-initiated task forces and because some members of this first MITF are members of Div 35. In 2011, members of Div 48, Society for the Study of Peace, Conflict, and Violence, Peace Psychology, were working together to discuss the possibility of a petition to annul Pens. According to Soltz, there were numerous emails back and forth among members, particularly with Linda Wolf and Kathleen Dockett. A majority of the ad hoc Div 48 committee agreed to annulment, and a majority of the Div 48 executive committee concurred. Wolf and Dockett disagreed and demanded that Arrigo and Edelson propose an alternative to the annulment petition, whereupon Arrigo and Edelson asked Wolf and Dockett to propose an alternative, which never materialized. As a result, Jean Maria Arrigo and Roy Edelson decided to largely work through the coalition. A separate task force was then formed in 2011 by Linda Wolf and others, William Strickland, Kathleen Dockett, and Julie Levitt, Laura Brown, who was on it originally but for personal reasons may not to attend the meetings. According to Edelson, when it was announced early in 2012, named the task force to reconcile policies related to psychologists' involvement in national security settings, Wolf gave the impression that the Div 48 members were participating in this task force as a part of their roles as leaders of Div 48, when in fact there was a considerable opposition within Div 48 to this task force. They appear to have been used to lend credibility to a task force that undermined the annulment petition, in that these individuals would be perceived as coming from a, quote, peace psychology perspective. Until the task force was announced, neither those working on the petition nor the Div 48 president knew about it. There were never any open opportunity for members to join, as there was with the current task force. Moreover, Bill Strickland's employment, CEO of defense contractor HRRO, was not revealed via the task force website. While the task force described its work as, quote, complementary, members of the coalition saw the formation of MITF as an attempt to deflect attention away from the petition that was circulating. Coalition members also saw this move to integrate PENS-related policies as problematic because such integrations would not change the policies as written. The 2012 MITF instead appeared to find merit in portions of the PENS task force report, stating that the PENS, quote, the PENS report offers unique contributions to APA policy, end quote, that needed to be integrated into a, quote, unified, comprehensive APA policy. The coalition named the 2012 MITF publicly as an anti-annulment task force and believed that its work would, quote, enshrine rather than annul the PENS report. Indeed, would, quote, delay much-needed deliberations and possible reform, end quote. And according to Edelson, was pretty clearly an effort to shut down the support they were building. 2015 Hoffman Report and events that followed. The events in this section and the sections that follow clearly relate to Div 35 and need no further explanation. The Hoffman Report was released in July 2nd, 2015. In anticipation of the EC35 meeting in Toronto that would take place at the beginning of the APA annual convention, August 6th through 10th, 2015, then Div 35 President Maureen McHugh began drafting a response to Hoffman from Div 35, consulting with EC35 members over the EC35 only listserv. She asked that EC35 members read the Hoffman report so that there could be discussion of it both via listserv and at the upcoming 2015 meeting. Preparation of a division statement in response to the Hoffman report. Past President McHugh reported in interview and follow-up email to MITF that when she was still president, she had received multiple correspondences from Div 35 members saying that Div 35 needed to write a response to the Hoffman report and that the EC35 listserv wasn't the right place to hold a discussion. Then-President-elect Garrett Akinsanya agreed that there should be a space open to members, too, for discussion. Given it would be difficult to begin an entirely new listserv, McHugh worked with Keith Cook, who suggested she open the Women of Color Leaders listserv in order to work with EC35 members to develop a response. Individuals started making suggestions for the response and sending documents and drafts from other divisions via the listserv, which she used to work on the response using statements from other divisions and PSYSR. McHugh then posted a draft of the listserv for feedback and discussion, reported that people responded to it, and that she then made changes based on feedback. There was discussion about the opening statement and the use of the word, quote, valid or, quote, unbiased. After several suggestions, someone suggested, quote, fair, and an unofficial vote on the word, quote, fair was supported by consensus. McHugh notes that Morehead Slaughter was among those who voted to use the word, quote, fair to describe the Hoffman report. McHugh told us that very late in the process, then-President-elect Garrett Akinesayu suggested, and I apologize for this pronunciation if this is wrong, suggested a series of wording changes and that changed the entire meaning of the document, including the wording around FAIR, and in the end expressed anger to McHugh that her changes had not been incorporated. McHugh noted that Garrett Akinsenyu indicated to her that she had not subscribed to the Women of Color listserv and so had not followed the comments of the members and so didn't realize that the statements were collaborative. According to McHugh, McHugh put the discussion of the statement on the EC35 Toronto agenda, but there was no discussion of it there. That may have been because the discussion about the Morehead Slaughter presidency took up the majority of time at that meeting. To summarize the response statements to the Hoffman Report, Div 35, 1, accepts the Hoffman Report as, quote, thorough and fair. 2, is, quote, ashamed that as a result, the result of APA's failure of leadership and our own may have contributed to the torture of those held in detention by the U.S. government. 3, condemns the ethical violations of APA leaders, staff, and members involved and demands public accountability from all those involved in order to regain public trust. 4, acknowledges our failures in 2007 to join with other groups opposing the composition and process of Penn's task force. 5, regrets not taking an early principled stand demanding APA uphold international standards, e.g. the Geneva Convention, UN Convention Against Torture, to enforce ethical policy. 6, acknowledges and apologizes for issuing a separate statement in 2012 that appeared to contradict CISR and DSJ's statement affirming safety, justice, and well-being of all people. 7, pledges to contribute, to bringing members and psychologists into a process of serious redemptive self-reflection in order to take necessary steps to build a more conscious, compassionate organization. 8, stands with other concerned psychologists committed to reforming APA to ensure a transparent and democratic process and to do all we can to reduce the possibility that such events will ever occur in the future. And 9, affirmed that as feminists and a social justice division, we confirm the importance of human dignity and well-being and of addressing human rights violations. See Appendix K for full statement. Tomorrow at 3 p.m., I will pick this up again and continue in the reading. Thank you very much for listening in. And again, I apologize for any mispronunciations. All mistakes in reading are my own. Have a great day.